Okay, so what I want to do with quantum explorations is tell you about quantum technology, but get you to engage in not only how to use quantum technologies, but what it's useful for and why you might be interested in pursuing that. And there's a widely held belief today that we're at the beginning of a broad expansion in our ability to engineer quantum systems. And it's been given a name. The second quantum revolution. You can find that in a lot of places. And for some people, it means that you have a quantum technologies that are engineered. And basically, that says, hey, I want to do something other than a simple clock, where I'm going to use as a clock what nature gives us and we'll rely upon an energy separation to give us a beating that we can count on. Okay, so for some people, this word engineered is what's important. And for others, it's entanglement that's important. To say, well, we've had lots of quantum devices. You know, there's the laser, there's tunneling transistors, there's MRI. But let's have a system where we can usefully use entanglement. And that will give us efficiencies that separate us from the so-called first quantum revolution. And for us, it really is both. You know, if you give up entanglement, you're not going to do anything useful in the quantum world. And if you don't bring some engineering to the problem, you're not going to be able to use entanglement because it's too fragile. Okay, so we want to bring those two pieces to this. And so what we want to do in this set of lectures is we want to understand the opportunity but we want to understand it in terms of physics. We'll come back to that. There's some tools that we need to develop in order to understand that. You know, one of the challenges of engineering a quantum device is to make it robust to the environment it finds itself in. So we'd like to think about, well, what are the tools we have to do this? And you know, these will include things like control elements. I don't need to write it down. You know, there'll be a little bit here of the various modalities. So if you want to build a quantum device, you could say, well, I'm going to build it out of superconducting electronics. I'm going to build it out of photons and some beam dividers and measurement apparatus. I'm going to build it out of ions, or I'm going to build it out of defects and solids. And we want to show some of the physics of that. But I want to try to be a little bit careful here, that as we describe that physics, it's so easy to drop into jargon. And then every one of these things sounds very different. And in fact, there's only a handful of things you can do in the quantum world. You know, that's the benefit of quantum mechanics, right? It's linear reversible. And so What we'll try to do, and you can help me with this, is to show you where these things are exactly the same. So I do want to spend some time on the modalities, and we'll cover superconductivity, we'll cover in B systems. As always, we'll spend some time with neutrons because it's it's the nicest, cleanest system to look at. But we'll show you what's the same with these things. And we want to understand how quantum technology allows us to do new things in physics. So for instance, if we gave you a general purpose quantum computer, then a lot of the things that we do in condensed matter, we would do in a different way. That a lot of the approximations we need to make in order to gain insight, we hope that we'll be able to gain insight in a different way. And there's, of course, many places where having tools, whether they're observational tools, can we see gravity waves? Well, sort of today. We can do it a little bit. Could we do it more robustly? Can we do it with higher precision? Can we hope to understand the interplay of quantum gravity? Can we start to observe dark matter and dark energy? All these things are reasonable places to look at for quantum devices. And so we want to give you the tools to look at that, but not only just give you the tools, we want to give you the perspective so that you can see how these things connect to the world around you. Now, I said it was an interesting time. And one of the reasons it's interesting is the world's governments have decided that future prosperity depends in some bit on having quantum technologies. And whether we're sitting in Canada, which just at UW, we were awarded a Canadian First Research Excellence Fund program that provides $140 million over 7 years to develop quantum technologies, or you're in China, where Zhang Weipan was just given $2 billion to develop quantum technologies, or you're in the EU, where they've asked for €1 million to develop quantum technologies, or in the UK, where they also have a big program. The idea is to say, hey, we can build quantum devices, and they will allow us to do things that are not possible in the classical world. And that these will broaden what we can accomplish, whether we're talking about controlling and monitoring the environment, looking at medicine, creating new materials. It'll impact broadly. And there's a bunch of reports, white papers. So the EU has a white paper called the Quantum Manifesto. Let me go down, I'll finish that. The UK has a bunch of quantum reports. They got started a little bit earlier, and white papers. Quantum report generally on what technology, quantum technologies can impact society, but then focused separate white papers on communication, computation, sensing. In the US, the White House has a report of course. This is Obama's White House, of a quantum study. And in Canada, we have the Quantum Canada Survey. I want to fill in a little bit of these URLs. What I'd like you to do for your tutorial on Wednesday is to go and read these. And I'm going to give you a set of questions about the impact of quantum technologies and for you to think about how to connect yourself in your interest to those. You know, what do you find most interesting? Now, the Quantum Manifesto is actually, let me save myself from writing all these down. There. So the Quantum Manifesto is pretty broad. It includes a roadmap of sorts to using quantum technologies. The UK report is very specific. It says, hey, we want to have this sensor for this oil exploration, or for finding these underground caverns, or we want this computer for optimizing the chemistry of this way of creating fertilizers. And so they've lost in the weeds. The White House report says, hey, we should all do this together. And okay, pretty lame. But it is right that you don't succeed at quantum technologies unless you have computer scientists, physicists, material scientists, and engineers all around the table. The Canadian piece basically just says that we play in this game too. It doesn't yet say this is a useful path forward. But the questions that I would like you to think about coming prepared to answer . So, you know, what do you find compelling out of the field? So there's, of course, no right answer to that. And separately, what do you think are the most impactful? The most impactful might be impactful to society. It might be impactful to advancing physics. Now, that's for you to say. You'll read in this that most of them discuss the theory as if it were done. It'll give some room for, well, we need new algorithms. We always need new algorithms. But this is by far not the case. And so to critique this and to say, where are the holes? And of course, whether I'm talking about quantum information science as a whole, quantum error correction, quantum computing, quantum sensing, quantum simulation, quantum control, quantum materials. And let me give you two examples. Quantum computing is often described as though we can do database searches. And we can say, oh, I can get a quadratic speed up. I've got Grover's algorithm. Life is great. But we forget, or we neglect, or we hide, that you have to put your data in a quantum database. And that's costly. And so how do you put your data in a quantum database without having gone through every element? And if you've gone through every element, then why do you need Grover Search? And so there are holes in this. If I think about the physics of technology, we treat errors as though they're Markovian. We take very simplistic views of what errors we allow, and that's necessary to make progress because we don't have a quantum computer yet. But there are big holes in the theory of saying, what computational tools do I have to look at non-Markovian, time-dependent, or qubit, or state-dependent errors, and develop control schemes that work for those as well? And we could give a lot, but I don't want to answer the questions. I want you to answer the questions. Maybe we've already said this, but this to physics specifically. You know that today there are MEMS experiments where we have a photon interacting with a mirror, and the precision of those is approaching what we need to understand quantum gravity, so that quantum gravity becomes an experiment that you do in the lab. And that is going to be one of the exciting things, right? In your career, the difference of physics today to what you'll see as physics 20 years from now is going to be fantastic. And having not only these tools, but these theories, is going to open up those doors for you. Of course, you know, there's a lot of beyond standard model physics. We can start to look at, or I mentioned dark matter, dark energy. And of course, the whole question of condensed matter physics. So the idea on Wednesday isn't to have a complete answer to these things. The idea on Wednesday is to be able to come and have a discussion where you can say, this is what you find compelling and why. And of course, you know, we can try to connect some of that to the class going forward. Okay. All right. You guys should also not be so quiet. That was a hint you could say something.
Sorry.
Okay. All right. So challenges teaching this class. You know, there's a few challenges. The biggest one, by and large, is that we cover so many fields and there's so much jargon connected to them that if you don't throw something at me now and then, we'll get lost in that. So bring something soft and feel free. The next piece, of course, is to try to talk precisely about quantum mechanics. You know, quantum mechanics, as we build an intuition for it, isn't simply about having a set of equations. It's about having an understanding. And of course, the early days really show that very clearly. And with quantum mechanics, we're burdened Because if we tell a story, and we tell a story that gives some physical reality, apparently, to a state, then, of course, we're missing the essence of quantum mechanics. And so, you know, this story that says the photon is in two places at once, you know, you should throw something heavy and hard at that person, right? The photon's not in two places at once. The wave function of the photon can be in a coherent superposition, absolutely, right? And the wave function is not an element of reality. You've heard this all before. It's a complete description of what we can learn about the system, right? That's what the wave function gives us. It gives us this complete description of what we can learn about that system. And so we have this challenge of saying, let's tell an honest story. Let's be careful about that. And of course, it's tempting at this point to, you know, I'm going to do it, to invoke Feynman. Feynman, you know, famously says that if someone thinks that they understand quantum mechanics, they don't. Of course, what he meant was you can't give a classical story. Now, he also says that it takes two generations in order to understand a new element of physics, and that the intuition for physics comes after two generations. You guys are more than two generations beyond Feynman. So whereas I don't have to understand it, you do. He also says that the only mystery of quantum mechanics is superposition. That's that first quantum revolution. And then later on, he says, oh, he was wrong. That entanglement is a unique and different mystery in quantum mechanics and must be approached that way. Okay, so the challenge is, of course, are going to be to say, can we give an honest story? And can we show where the powers are in a clear way? All right, so our story, the range of modalities. Another challenge is applications. Applications tend to take us to a different field. And so if you're saying, oh, I want to build a quantum sensor, quantum sensor that came out of my lab was to look at the margins of liposarcomas, long way from what we do. An application out of Kevin Resch's lab was to look at optical coherence tomography for medical imaging, you know, a long way from his bread and butter stuff. So the modalities tend to take us further away from quantum mechanics. And yet the opportunity is to connect those things. And we'll try to do this a little bit, but I'm going to underplay that, unfortunately. We tend to introduce quantum technologies as idealizations. And then quantum mechanics sounds very easy. If we mentioned teleportation earlier today, if I wrote down the circuit for teleportation and we went through it, you would see that it's easy on paper to teleport a state from one physical implementation to another. And the challenge of the field is, of course, that we need to have these idealizations. But the idealizations are a very, very long way away from what we can actually do. And so we need instead to think about this in terms of robust implementations. And a nice way of organizing this is we typically say that we have some gate. And so then we're saying, oh, I have this unitary operator, and it's going to act. But of course, this gate is composed from some time-dependent Hamiltonian. And this time-dependent Hamiltonian might actually be a set of those. And the whole thing is going to lead to some map over the process. And that map is going to, of course, admit noise and imperfections. And even depending upon the structure of the space that we're considering in this, the map may not be CP. So, you know, we have this idealization, but you don't want to think about the idealization as the sum of where you want to go. That if you only have the idealization, quantum sounds a little bit more powerful than we've been able to demonstrate that it is. Okay. Now I want to talk about some simple examples in the near term. As you go through all of these things, you'll see that they have timelines. And they're incredibly ambitious. The field started about 1995 to 1996. In fact, the first quantum simulators were implemented in the 70s. You know, long predate Feynman's ideas. Feynman gave it a lot more structure than those early days had. But you know, at this point, we had Shor's algorithm. Love Grover gave us his algorithm. And a number of people, including Peter Shor, gave us quantum error correction. And having these two, you know, really excited the field. Having this enables the field, okay? And at this point, there were a handful of implementations that could operate over 2 qubits. And of course, we're always referencing ourselves to Moore's law. And Moore's law is for classical computation, and it says that you get a factor of 2 every 18 months to 2 years. Depends upon whose quote of Gordon Moore you believe. Okay, so we're 20 years later, and you know, if we're every 2 years, well, fine, then we should have 12 qubits. Every 18 months, we should have 15 qubits. And this is where we are. You know, so the good news is we're keeping up with Moore's law. And I should have said that, of course, to double the Hilbert space, to double the computational space, let me not say Hilbert space here, all we need to do is add 1 qubit every year, or every 18 months, or every 2 years. And that sounds good, except that if I want to beat a classical computer, then I need to have a much, much larger. So if I was to say, take a classical computer and use it to simulate a quantum computer, then your laptops can simulate 22, 24 qubits. You work a little harder, you can simulate 27. You know, if you take the biggest computers that we know of, then we can get to about 33 qubits. So if we need to have 50 qubits, in order to do something beyond the classical process, sounds like a long time. And of course, those are 50 idealized qubits. And if I have error correction that I'm applying to this, then maybe we need to add 1,000 qubits for every qubit. Maybe we need to add 1,000,000 qubits for every qubit. Depends upon what we're doing. And so this scaling, which has been fun for the last 20 years, isn't going to cut it. And that's what these reports are going to tell you. They're going to tell you today is different, that the scaling will dramatically change. And it hasn't happened yet, but there's a few ways we'll be able to know if it is. So what are the next steps? The next step, one of them, is to keep one qubit of information alive and to be able to do that indefinitely using quantum error correction. So you have some state. And of course, if I leave the state to itself, it's going to decohere, so there'll be some lifetime. And the lifetime, if you're sitting with a superconducting qubit, is at best a millisecond. If I'm sitting with a solid state defect or an ion, it can be, at best an hour, which would be great. Hard to have a processor out of those. But we do have qubits, one qubit. But what we want to do is to say, okay, let's take this and we're going to add qubits. And have structured noise. So that we're able to extend the information by spreading it over a state of this larger Hilbert space. And an example is to use a state like so, and to have a noise that behaves the same on both qubits. Or alternatively, we could have a long correlation time. So here's one way of doing error correction. It says, find something magical. And there are these magical places. The other way is to, again, add qubits and measurement. And to do quantum error correction. So I imagine I have a Hilbert space where my original state is sitting here. And I have a number of other subspaces. And if I can arrange, so this is a 2x2, right? It's holding a qubit. If I can arrange that the noise maps uniquely to these other subspaces, then I can correct that noise. And so here, with this simple code, we would be able to correct three distinct noise processes. And of course, you need to expand that and expand it to collect all the noise processes, but one can systematically do this. The challenge is to combine these two and preserve the information . So combine those and preserve the information for a time long compared to the information to the single qubit ability to preserve information. And this piece is necessary for everything. That if you're going to say you're going to have a long distance communication protocol, but you can't hold information. Or if you're going to say, I'm going to make a quantum processor that can outperform a classical processor, but coherence is not important. It's a very unlikely statement, right? Because now you're saying, oh, something very close to a classical process, your quantum processor is something very close to a classical processor. So this is a one of the grand challenges of the field, and something that people expect to see in 0 to 5 years. It, of course, would open the door for communication, would open the door for sensing. If we have a qubit that we can keep alive, we can do wonderful sensing. Now, a more ambitious thing is a suggestion by a variety of people, but named by John Preskill, of saying, can we demonstrate quantum supremacy? Meaning, can I make a quantum processor that provably outperforms a classical processor? In fact, can I make a quantum processor that provably outperforms any classical processor? Now, you have to be careful with this one. If I only said, I want you to go in the lab and do something quantum mechanical that you can't simulate on a classical computer, it's very, very, very easy. You know, we've been doing that since the 40s. Okay? Probably we've been doing it for longer than that. Well, we've known we were doing it since the 40s. Okay. And what quantum supremacy says is, no, we're not trying to use a classical computer in this direction to show that a classical computer can't perform a quantum operation. That we know. What we're going to do instead is to say we're going to go this way, and that we want to rely upon a structured process and one that we can sample from, such that the statistics of sampling over this problem can't be reproduced on any classical processor. I want to say one more thing about this. You know, it's tempting when we're building classical quantum processors to come up with a model of our quantum processor and then show that a classical computer can't run that model. But that's not what we're doing. What we're doing is we're saying that we have a computational problem that we're trying to solve. And we're solving it on a quantum computer, and we're solving it on a classical computer. And the two computational models, quantum and classical, have no reference to each other other than they're both trying to solve this problem. So they're both going to solve it in the best way they can, the most efficient way available to them, and ask, can we demonstrate that as the size of the problem increases, our quantum compute processor running in the lab, a real system, can do something that any classical processor can't. And this we're perhaps close to it. If you believe John Martini's projections, it'll happen this year. It's a little bit tricky to believe his projections because we still have this piece here. Okay? If you believe IBM's projections, you know, maybe it happens in the next 5 to 10 years. We certainly hope that things go faster. But it's a well-structured problem. And because of the work that John's done and the work that Scott Aronson has done, actually, this is quite, we have a target. It's not proved, but we have a good target for that. Okay. As always, I take up too much time. Over the next 0 to 5 years, it's stated that we'll have a quantum repeater, or at least all the working elements of a quantum repeater. And of course, a quantum repeater says that I have some state, that I can connect it via measurement to an entangled state. Right here I have an entangled state. And I'm going to make a measurement of this in the Bell basis. And then based upon these classical outcomes, provide a unitary that returns the state over here. And there's a lot of pieces you could think about using this for. One, of course, it takes a state from this qubit to that qubit. And of course, you don't learn the state, but it was reliably transferred. The other is, if you're clever, this qubit could be a photon, and this qubit could be a magnetic energy level in a trapped ion, or it could be a magnetic level in a defect, or it could be a current state, the superposition of current states in a quantum circuit. And with small changes to this, we can teleport gates, we can teleport error correction, or of course, once we have this from a flying qubit to a stored qubit, or from a stored qubit to a flying qubit, but once we have it stored, stationary, then we can think about applying error correction. So quantum repeaters will have this transduction problem of get your photon into a stationary qubit, and we'll be able to connect nodes of flying qubits. There's been a lot of progress. We'll talk about some of that. It was assumed back here that this was going to be the easiest thing to do, and that we would have this done in no time. Okay. Two more things to talk about. Quantum sensing. The idea of quantum sensing says that we can use entanglement to make a more precise measurement of something than we could otherwise. And so I have some state. And I'm going to take a series of qubits that are my measurement apparatus. And of course, always we'll create an entangled state out of these. So here I have an n-qubit cat state. And I want to measure the state of this qubit. And the nice piece is with only one call to that qubit, and with this external qubit interacting with only one of these, right? That's the power of entanglement. That if you interact with any part of an entangled state, you interact with the whole entangled state. That at the end of this piece, if I looked at the state here, I get the nice linear map that if psi is zero, then this state is all in the fiducial zero state. And if psi was one, then the state is all in the fiducial one state. And of course, linearity holds. And so now then we can say, instead of measuring one qubit, I can measure n qubits to learn the state. And I can hopefully make that more robust so I can get a more precise measure of the state. And the last piece of this says, well, in fact, once I create this entangled state, I can take this part of the processor away. So that if I want to bring a qubit to make a measurement, I only need to bring this qubit. I don't need to bring the rest of them. They can stay hidden away in some nice, quiet place. Okay. The last piece is quantum simulation. So quantum simulation says, imagine I have a lattice of qubits, and I want to write a Hamiltonian, which isn't their natural Hamiltonian. And I want to study the spectrum, or I want to study the thermalization, if I have a bath, or I want to study the dynamics of this. And of course, we would like to have simulation. On the one hand, it'd be lovely to think we could make a simulator that will look at materials and tell us this is the materials we should use to make a room temperature superconductor, or this is the materials that we should use to make a topological insulator. It's also nice to think about it in terms of chemical reactions, to say, oh, I can find new chemical processes by looking. And there's, you'll see in many of the reports, people point to fertilizer production. If we just change the efficiency of that. Or we can think about, hey, can I create a material that's going to be a better solar collector of energy. And so you imagine that you have some lattice of qubits, and that if I looked locally, I would have connections that are nearest neighbor. And the other piece that we often think about is that this structure written over this lattice that we could implement on this 2D lattice, a translationally invariant. Invariant, nearest neighbor, Hamiltonian. And if we could do that, then we could start to explore problems in condensed matter, and we could start to look at the electron transport and electronic structure of materials. Again, 2D, because you'll see over the class that 2D is a lot easier than 3D. This piece, if I just want this 5-qubit structure, you can do that today by logging on to IBM's Quantum Explorations website. Have you guys done that? No. So IBM has a website, which is open to everyone, called Quantum Explorations. And it has a structure exactly like this. And it's running it's not tied to a simulator, it's not tied to an emulator, it's tied to a physical piece of equipment in their lab, which is a superconducting-based quantum processor. And over a Hilbert space spanned by 5 qubits, you have universal control. You can do anything you want. This piece, to say that I can go from 5 to 100 in 5 years, it's probably possible. You know, it'll be noisy. You'll see that the 5 is a little bit noisy already. But it gives us a new tool to start looking at physics and to explore what we can do there. Okay, so I meant to tell you a little bit more about what's happening for applications and then start with the physics tomorrow. We'll start with the physics tomorrow anyways. If you want to get together sometime and say, what are the quantum devices that exist today? You know, there are quantum technologies that have been out there in the field and being used since the 40s. What are the targets of opportunity? Well, you'll see some of those when you read those reports. And, you know, I'd like to know what out of those you find compelling. Okay, so we'll stop here.